excused. We'll now turn to 33-7061, United States v. Bruce.
While the attorneys are getting assembled here, I'll give you a brief summary of this case. In this case, there was a jury trial that convicted the defendant, Stetson Bruce, of sexually abusing his 5-year-old son, R.W. With minors, we use their initials, so his son was R.W. In this direct criminal appeal, Bruce raises two primary arguments for reversal. First, Bruce challenges the district court's decision to admit into evidence a video recording of two out-of-court forensic interviews, one with R.W., and that was the defendant, and one with R.W.'s sister, who witnessed the alleged abuse, who testified to that effect. Bruce argues that the interview recordings are inadmissible hearsay evidence. The district court, and a hearsay evidence is evidence that is outside of court. The district court admitted the recordings under an exception which allows hearsay evidence to be admitted if it is a prior consistent statement which can only be admitted to rehabilitate a witness's credibility after that credibility has been attacked. And the government also argues it is admissible under another exception for medical treatment statements for diagnosis purposes. And finally, the government says there's a third exception that should allow the evidence to come in under the residual hearsay exception, which is a catch-all exception to hearsay if the evidence is shown to be particularly reliable. In addition, Bruce argues that the district court abused its discretion by giving the interview recordings out of court to the jury for viewing during the jury deliberations without first playing those videos in court itself.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Anderson?
Good morning, Your Honors. It pleases the court and counsel, John Anderson, on behalf of defendant appellant Stetson Bruce. It is my intention this morning, Your Honors, to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I will monitor my own time to that end. Your Honors, Mr. Bruce was sentenced to life imprisonment after a trial that was marked by the admission of powerful hearsay evidence in the form of forensic interviews with the victim, R.W., and his sister, E.R. The admission of this evidence was unsupported by any factual findings by the district court or any legal analysis by the district court. And on appellate review in this court, that evidence, the admission of that evidence, finds no support in any applicable rule of evidence such that the district court's admission of the evidence was an abuse of discretion. This evidence formed a centerpiece of the government's case at trial, such that the government cannot carry its burden of establishing harmlessness of the evidence. And accordingly, we are asking this court to reverse Mr. Bruce's convictions. Your Honors, I would like to begin this morning, if I may, by addressing potential admissibility under Rule 801 D1B2.
Before you launch into that, there's a lot made of how the district court didn't elaborate at all, really, on the reasons why this evidence was admissible. And so should we be thinking about this under Rule 801? I mean, that's what the government... There's one mention where the government says, how about 801? And it seems the court proceeded with that. Is that where we should be focusing our attention?
It's a good question, Your Honor. And again, as I mentioned in my brief, I'm at a bit of a loss as to march through the possible avenues of admissibility. Of course, part of this court's task is to determine whether it's admissible under any theory under the rules. That is where I started because that is the argument that the government made. But I'm not sure in terms of an order of operations, where do we start? Do we start with it is a non-hearsay under 801 or do we start with an exception? Okay. Your Honor, touching on D1B2 is, I wanted to expand on that a little bit. And I don't disagree. 801D2B, I get confused with that a little bit, but 801D2B, the government suggests that that is, that the statements or the interviews would be admissible under that provision because the defendant attacked the credibility of ER and RW at trial. And I can't disagree with the idea that there was an attack on the credibility of these witnesses at trial. But this court has made clear, and certainly the advisory committee's commentary to the rule made clear, that an attack on credibility is by itself insufficient to support admission under D1B2. The touchstone for admissibility under D1B2 is the rehabilitative value of the evidence. And what D1B2 does is, if there is a rehabilitative value, then the evidence can come in not just for the purpose of the rehabilitation, but as substantive evidence.
Well, here, why wasn't the testimony as opposed to the witness challenged here under the argument that the witness was confused between a prior act of sex that minor witness observed involving the father and the charged offense of sexual act by the father against his minor son?
I'm sorry, is Judge Ebell, is your question why is that not rehabilitative in that respect?
Of the evidence, right. Not of the witness, but of the evidence.
Judge Ebell, I think that it is not rehabilitative of the idea that he committed the act, or certainly the witness's credibility here, right, which is what, as I understand it, Rule 801 D1B2 speaks to. And here, one of the critical components, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm answering your question, Judge Ebell, but it does not rehabilitate the witness's credibility.
The fact that the witness gave a similar account, the same account, a year and a half or 2 years earlier, doesn't say something about credibility, that the person can recite the same events?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. And I will get to, and I think it depends on what the attack is on the credibility too, because one of the things the government points out here is that the line of defense here was that abuse of the nature alleged in the indictment would have left physical injuries. With respect to that, certainly that does not address, as the United States Supreme Court said in Tomei, it does not, the defense does not meet the assault. In other words, establishing the presence.
You have to be careful about relying too much on Tomei because the rule's been amended since then.
Understand, Your Honor.
Does it even apply to subpart two?
That's a good question, Judge Rossman. I think it does. The commentary says that the temporal carryover in the new rule carries over from Tomei. And I think it's an important discussion here because one of the questions here is at what point does the infirmity develop? In other words, if there is an attack and the government says, well, there's an attack on faulty memory or faulty recollection, there certainly was no finding here by the district court that at the time the initial statement was made that recollection was not faulty. And if you look...
Whose burden is it to identify the relevant point in time?
I believe it's the government's burden, Your Honor. As the proponent of that evidence, the government needs to show the threshold findings of admissibility, threshold elements of admissibility. And certainly here, to come back to the initial point that underlies all of this, there were no findings from the district court that established the basis for admissibility of the evidence.
So in light of the chronology that Tome insists on for the rule, and if it applies to subpart two, is it your position that in the absence of a finding by the district court, that there's nothing for us to defer to?
Yes, Your Honor. And there is no finding that at the time that statement was made, the faulty memory had not arisen yet. And it's part of the dynamic that gets into the pretrial nature of the ruling here, because the defense, the faulty memory defense, was given the admissibility or the determination of the district court pretrial that this evidence was going to come in with only foundational testimony. Defense counsel had to go into this attacking not just the witness's in-court testimony, but the statements that were made in the forensic interviews that were going to be submitted to the jury. And in doing that, so there was an attack on the faulty memory. Your memory wasn't just faulty as you testified here today. It was faulty at the time you made those earlier recorded interviews. And remember, those took place 2 years after, more than 2 years after the alleged abuse in this case.
So I'm trying to think of what the nature of our review is here. If you're saying that the problem was that the judge didn't make any a finding necessary to apply the exception, then what do we do if we agree with you? Do we reverse and then have a new trial where the judge may make a finding and we're right back where we started?
Yeah.
Or are you saying there's no way the judge could make a finding?
I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. I don't think there was, I wouldn't say that the district court couldn't make a finding. What I am comfortable saying to the court is the district court made no findings. We have no understanding of even what rule the district court believed submitted supported admission of this evidence.
So should we just reverse the verdict and judgment? Or do we send it back down for the judge to make findings regarding the admissibility of this particular evidence? Should we just limit it to that? And if the judge says, I make this finding, and it's, well, say the judge says, I can't make the necessary finding, then you win. And it has to be retried without that evidence, if it's going to be retried at all. But if the judge says, I make the necessary finding, then it comes back to us to see if that was a reasonable finding. How do we proceed when the judge doesn't make finding on the record?
Well, this court has, in Perez and other cases, expressed a reluctance to make its own findings. You know, whether to look at the record and make a finding as opposed to saying, is a finding of the district court supported? I think what this court needs to do is reverse the conviction and send it back down for a new trial with...
Well, why is a new trial necessary if we're just missing a ruling on evidence that could be... I see no reason why it has to go to a full trial to have that resolved.
I don't think the record that we have, Judge Hartz, is sufficient to support that. There are other components that may go into a determination of the threshold questions under 801 or the 8034 or 807 analysis here. So,
and you think it'd be improper to have an evidentiary hearing on the admissibility of the evidence on remand and just have that decided? I don't know what we've done in the circumstances. I'm asking your help.
I don't think that having an evidentiary hearing here would be by itself sufficient without a new trial to answer those threshold questions in a vacuum outside of the trial that has already been conducted.
But the trial, but the judge would be the same judge who did the trial. And he may say, he or she may say, I can't make that ruling now because I've forgotten the details. But the judge might also say, I remember that pretrial, that trial clearly. I remember when this evidence came in, and I did rule it was admissible. I remember that because the evidence came in. But let me explain why I ruled that way. Couldn't we give the judge the opportunity to say that? And then we can save the trial if the judge rules it's okay.
I suppose you could. I think that would be difficult, Judge Ebell, to go back and reconstruct that these years later.
A lot of times the judge will say, I can't do it. But sometimes they say, I can. I can remember.
I suppose that's one would be one avenue of doing it, Judge Ebell. I would have concerns given the state of the record and allowing the defendant to adduce, you know, any additional evidence or argument that,
well,
that bears.
The judge wouldn't, we wouldn't tell the judge to take new evidence. We would say on the evidence in the transcript before you, what do you remember?
I don't know that I've ever seen that done, Judge Ebell, in my experience, but.
Judge Hartz is always coming up with creative solutions.
No,
so
no, I just
prepare
don't want to waste
yourself.
Time. I just don't want to waste time. And I must say, my memory is, I don't ever recall this happening.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. I don't recall that. But it would certainly be a potentially viable avenue. My position is that it would have to go back for a new trial at the end of the day.
And counsel, isn't your position, if I understand it correctly, about the need for a new trial related in some way to your argument about the threshold motion in limine error?
Absolutely.
Can you speak to that argument?
To the threshold. Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor, and I consider that sort of the kicking off point, you know, when you're off by a degree or so and you go down the road and then you're a mile away from your target. What happened here was the district courts ruled in response to the motion in limine that the forensic interviews would be admitted. It went on and said that they would not be shown to the jury, would be given to them in deliberation. The court went on to discuss, are we going to admit a full or just a truncated version? So it was really that error that put defense counsel in a position of not only having to address the witness's trial testimony, but having to address the forensic interviews as well. And that, again, is incompatible with the rationale behind Rule 801. The advisory commentary to Rule 801 says, should the defendant choose to open the door to this prior consistent statement, we see no reason why it should not come in as substantive evidence. And here,
did the judge, at the motion for limine and ruling on that, did the judge say, I'm going to admit it, or just say, I'm denying the motion in limine? We'll see what happens at trial.
He did not say we'll see what happens at trial. He said the evidence will be admitted upon proper foundation testimony. When the government admitted this testimony, all it did was it put up the interviewer and essentially said, do you see that CD that has your initials on it? Is that a copy of the interview? Yes, it is. Move admission of the interview. So there was not the type of foundation that we ordinarily consider in terms of 801 and the idea of opening the door to the testimony.
It's more just authentication.
Correct, Your Honor. Exactly, that's exactly right. It was authentication.
I have another question.
Absolutely, Judge.
Could you speak to your argument on Rule 43, the sending of the videos to the jury room without playing them in open court? You don't address that in your reply. I just wanted to know what the status of that argument is.
Yes, Your Honor. It is a live argument. And again, I have Circuit Court precedent from the Ninth Circuit on that says it's structural error.
What if it's not structural error?
If it's not structural error, I don't prevail in the argument. And as I see, I have about a minute left. I'd reserve that for rebuttal, if I may.
Ms. Williams? Why don't you start by explaining how we can affirm when the judge didn't make predicate findings?
I will love to start there, Your Honor. Lisa Williams, representing the United States of America. So the judge could have made more findings about what he was thinking in admitting this evidence. The government isn't going to argue that there is a plethora of information that gets us inside Judge Jones' head, but that is not required for this court. Those type of detailed findings aren't required for this court to analyze the issue on appeal. The standard of review here, of course, is abuse of discretion.
Could you be really specific about why the findings aren't required if we're analyzing this under 801? Because it seems to me that they are.
So this court's task is to determine whether or not the district court made a clear error of judgment or exceeded the bounds of permissible choice. And in doing so, the court, and this is, I cited the Davis case, but it's well established law, the appellate court can affirm the rulings on 801, 803, subsection 4, 807. This court can affirm the lower court's rulings on any ground that finds support in the record. So this court is able to look at the record on appeal and affirm the admission of the evidence on any ground, which indicates making its own factual determinations, even if the district court's factual determinations are lacking.
I don't disagree with anything you said as a general matter. If we are analyzing this as the government urges us to under subpart 2, and Tome applies, or at least doesn't destabilize how we're supposed to understand the federal rules, and we are seeking a finding about timing, about chronology, and there isn't one, how could we possibly affirm under subpart 2?
So I would submit that Tome does destabilize to some bit the analysis under B2, because, of course, that's the 2014 amendment put in well after Tome. But here's what I would submit, Your Honor.
Is that your argument for why Tome doesn't necessarily apply? Is that, I just want to make sure I know the scope of your
position. I don't think that this court has to resolve whether or not Tome has been destabilized or applies to affirm this matter. I don't think that this court needs to reach that. I think that the very best argument for the admission of ER's interview is a B2 argument. And the very best argument for RW's admission is a B1 argument. And so I'd like to pull those apart and look at each one of those. So
could you answer my question first on, about part two?
Yeah, so B2, and that's what I was going to say. I don't think RW fits as neatly under B2 as it does B1, so I'm going to focus on EW with B1. EW, the allegation against her was that she has transposed the site of her father and Amy having sex, and it has created a false memory that then led her to say that she saw her father having sex with RW. There's this false memory line of attack. And B2 is to rehabilitate that memory. Now, the timing that this happens is EW says to her mother, I saw Dad and Amy having sex. And by the way, this reminds me that I also saw Dad having sex with my younger brother. That's how this all kind of gets to the forensics interview stage. And so when EW shows up for that forensics interview, she had just a few days ago recently seen her dad and Amy having sex. And so the idea that she would be confusing this very recent memory with what she saw 2 years in the past is not credible. And so introducing the prior interview of when she gave that information so recent to observing the adult sex act, rehabilitates her against the argument that she's falsely transposing these memories. And it really goes to the meat of what B2 is designed to allow. For RW, the argument is slightly different because the best argument for RW is not a rehabilitation argument, which is a B2. It's a rebut, an express or implied claim of recent fabrication. And that happened when defense counsel asks RW, well, you know, you've talked to the prosecutor quite a bit and he's told you what to say. Right then and there, that opens the door to admissibility to his prior interview. Now, and I do want to correct the record on this because defense counsel argues in the reply brief that there is nothing in the record to support when the government spoke with RW. That's not true. In fact, the very first line of redirect examination that government counsel did with RW was to clear up how many times and when he had spoken with the child. And the government attorney spoke to RW twice. Once was a few days before trial, and once was earlier in that year. And this case was tried in July of 2022, so earlier in the year is earlier in 2022. The forensics interview took place a year before that, in 2021. And so at this point, when defense counsel suggests that the government is coaching RW, helping him what to say, helping him how to testify at trial, they have opened the door under B1 to admit the prior interview to rebut that claim, to rebut the claim that the government is feeding RW what to say, because RW said these same exact words a year prior to even talking to the government attorney. So those are the two, I believe, strongest arguments for why 801 admits both interviews, albeit a little different for each one.
That was very helpful. Thank you. I have a remaining question, and it really does relate to the threshold problem that I see in this case, which is we agree with you about 801 sort of after the fact. You know, the concentration of the rule is, as the Supreme Court tells us, on rebutting. It's about rebutting charges, and the government started there. The government, you know, you said at our peril. We talked about this in opening, at our peril. Why isn't that... Well, it's not alleged to be misconduct, and maybe it isn't misconduct, and I'm not suggesting so, but it's certainly problematic and seems to be entirely inconsistent. It's like the argument that you've just provided on the subpart 1 and 2 seems entirely divorced from how this is in the case at all. Why isn't that an enormous problem for the government?
You know, Your Honor, it's hard for me to argue. That is not a choice. Had I been trial counsel, I would not have referenced these interviews in openings because My read of this record makes very clear that they had not been admitted, and they would only do so if the proper foundation would be laid. And I think where defense counsel and I really differ on this argument is what the court means by laying the proper foundation. And that's really, I think, what this court is going to have to resolve is what the court meant to that. With being the government attorney, what I see in that is it's not an authentication. It's not, these videos are true and accurate copies of what was said and they haven't been manipulated. It is the foundational requirements that 801 requires. I mean, as a threshold matter, both children had to testify, right? The rule requires that the witness testify and be subject to cross-examination. That, to the government, is a foundational requirement of the rule.
That makes sense, but maybe I misunderstand what happened at the trial. But before trial, the judge said, I'll let it in if the foundational requirements are met. And then at trial, the judge let it in as soon as it was authenticated.
Oh, I disagree, Your Honor. Okay. These videos didn't come in until after both children had testified, subject to cross-examination, and then they introduced them. There was a couple of other witnesses that testified as well. Opening statements had been made, and then only when the interviewers were called, I believe as the fifth or sixth witnesses, did they come in. And so the government's argument is it laid the fact, it didn't expressly say now, you know, there wasn't a well-developed argument. The record is lacking that. But the calling of the witnesses, the cross-examination, those are all of the foundational boxes that are getting checked off as the trial proceeds. And then once the government goes to admit the videos and also authenticates them through those witnesses and the videos are true and accurate copies, then all of the foundation requirements of 801 have been met and have been laid, and that's why they're finally admitted.
So we have to, even to engage with your merits argument on 801, really ignore how this got in the case improperly in the first place.
Well, I don't think, I guess you could say ignore it, Your Honor. That's a harsh word. I don't think it's relevant to the inquiry. At the end of the day.
Why not? I'm really struggling with that. So can you help me? If we're writing this in favor of your position, what do we do with the way that this evidence was injected into the case?
At the end of the day, the trial court never pre-admitted this evidence. It never said it's coming in.
It didn't pre-admit as a matter of law?
Correct.
But didn't that fundamentally, that ruling on the motion in limine, fundamentally affect the trajectory of the defense?
I don't think it did because of the fundamental characteristics of this case. And you have two children who are going to come into court and say the defendant did these sex acts, right? Like this is not surprise testimony. Going in, everybody knows that this case is going to center around these two kids testifying. And because of that, we see a lot that says, from defense counsel, the argument that this made the defense go on offense and had to, they had to do that anyway, Your Honor. I mean, these kids are coming in and they're saying what they're saying. And so I think that the posturing of this case and the way the record is more about the facts of this case and what it's about than some sort of procedural error that's going to be, that the court has to address. And I think I would be remiss in not using some of my last time to, of course, turn to the argument that this court need not figure out if there's error here, because, of course, the government has its harmless error argument. Both children testified. And again, going back to this case, you have ER making a statement after seeing her dad and Amy have sex, making a statement that, oh, this also happened to my brother. These children have not spoken with each other. They haven't been in the same room. They haven't seen each other for 2 years. And they pull RW in. Nix, the grandmother, testifies that she doesn't even know why they're there. Okay, so nobody tells RW why he's there for the forensics interview. And yes, he doesn't admit right away what happens, but then he does say, my dad placed his TT in my butt, right? Talking about anal sex. These are not children whose stories are inconsistent. It's not, you know, maybe he touched my penis or he put his mouth over my penis. They describe the same exact sex act, independent of each other, with no motive to lie. What is R.W.'s motive to lie? And so that alone, that is such powerful evidence. And then they testify to at trial that the omission of the videos, which are cumulative, really is harmless error. But aside from the children's testimony, right, you have Nick saying that R.W. was very upset after living with his dad. He would cry. Daddy's being mean to me. He doesn't want to go back. The preschool teacher that the defense called as their own witness talked about the change that she saw in R.W.'s behavior at school, that he was a happy little boy and then all of a sudden would cry and say he doesn't want to go back to dad's house.
Counsel, is your argument on harmlessness, the content of it, is it the same for the alleged error of showing the videos only in the jury room? In other words, sorry, that was not an artful question. Is it harmless in the government's view if we don't assess that error under structural rubric because of, you know, all the reasons you've just recited that go to the admission of the videos in the first place?
I don't think that you could have a structural error that's harmless, Your Honor.
It's not structural.
If it's not structural, then it is. Not only is it not harmless, but defense has to show some prejudice that he suffered as a result of not showing the videos, and he's just failed to do so. I mean, the videos, by all...
So the analysis, is different. If we conclude that the Rule 43 error, construed as a constitutional error, is not structural, we apply harmlessness analysis there. Your position is that the defendant did not meet his burden to show prejudice?
That's correct, Your Honor. Because I don't know what prejudice could result in the jury not seeing additionally
bad evidence. Cumulative?
It's cumulative, but it's not good evidence. And I see I'm out of time if I may finish the question. It's not helpful evidence for the defense. So how could there be any prejudice from the jury not viewing inculpatory evidence? That's more of the government's argument is,
But they didn't, the viewing is an open court.
Correct.
That's the issue, right?
Yes, that's correct. And we don't know if they viewed it in the jury room.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Your Honors, I'd like to come back and touch on just a couple of points that my colleague raised. The first is the structure, the idea of what was the impact and effect of the district court's pretrial ruling. I don't think it is a fair reading of this record to suggest that what the district court did was essentially deny the motion limine to exclude the evidence and say we will figure it out later on a trial depending on how that unfolds. The district court said it would be admitted upon foundation testimony. The district court then made the determination that it would be not be shown to the jury, but would be provided to them in the jury room. Again, there was a very lengthy colloquy about would the full video be provided or only a truncated version. The government then put on a witness to talk about the process of forensic interviewing and how it works. So this was clearly understood. And, of course, in opening statement, the first words out of the government's mouth were right from that forensic interview. So,
counsel, so let's say we disagree with you as a matter of law on the motion in limine ruling, what do you say to the government's argument made here today that we shouldn't ignore? That's a harsh word, was my word, but that really it's the fundamental characteristics of this case that ameliorate whatever problem there may have been by injecting this evidence into the case in the way that it did.
Well, Your Honor, I don't agree that there's anything unique about this case that changes or ameliorates the way that the evidence came in particular with respect to R.W. I see that I'm out of time, and may I finish?
Yes.
My answer. Particularly with respect to R.W. and coming back to the discussion with the assistant U.S. attorney, again, defense counsel is operating based on the district court's ruling on the belief that this was coming in, and any discussion or line of questioning just couldn't make it worse because that evidence was coming in.
Thank you,
counsel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you,
counsel. Case is submitted. Counselor excused. That was an excellent argument. I'm glad our visitors got to hear. And the one